Okay, any questions and comments before we move on? Well, this is our session devoted to thinking skills, and we're reading the book The Secret Knowledge by David Mamet. Mamet is a famous playwright, screenwriter, and director with credits in the cinema world that include Wag the Dog and Heist. He's a Jew. He grew up in a family which was knee-jerk liberal. He did not even know a conservative growing up. After he moved to Hollywood, however, he met a rabbi who was conservative and who introduced him to conservative writers and thinkers, Milton Friedman, Thomas Sowell, Friedrich Hayek, and others. He began a gradual transformation of updating his thinking, meaning that he began thinking for the first time about political assumptions and beliefs he had entertained all of his life. So this is the story of his transformation into a conservative. It's not really the story of that as much as having documented that in an earlier piece, he is now concerned that the left, the unthinking left, is step-by-step dismantling American culture and is concerned about that. Now, I'm not interested in this as a story of true believers. I'm interested in the process of a world-famous thinker, Pulitzer Prize-winning, reevaluating his beliefs and exchanging them for new ones. Mamet states that he did not shift from liberal to conservative as much as he realized that he has always acted as a conservative, not as a liberal. He professed liberal beliefs, even Marxist socialist beliefs, but he actually lived as a conservative. And it was that realization that gave him the impetus to change. Many of his early plays were stridently anti-capitalist. He deeply admired the communist writer Bertolt Brecht. But then it occurred to him that capitalism was actually supporting his lifestyle. He was not paid by the government. He earned his own way. The idea of the secret knowledge comes from the quotation at the start of the book. I'm going to read that for you as soon as I can open it to it. This is a quote from Anna Simons, The Company They Keep. Most initiations are about the devolution of responsibility. At the same time, initiations often double as a long and confused moment of shared truths. Essentially, what the adults, elders, or senior members of the group share with the initiates is the knowledge they possess, and then they admit to a terrible secret, the secret of the tribe, that beyond the knowledge the initiates have just been given, there is no special knowledge. And so his book is called The Secret Knowledge because he grew up and lived most of his life until he was 60, believing that there was a secret knowledge and that only elitists could lead the country. And then he realized that the essence of conservatism was there ain't no secret knowledge. Anybody can lead the country. Anybody can do a better job than Obama. And this is one of the great fallacies of the current times, is that the press is making it seem like Republicans running for the nomination are just a bunch of rubes. None of them are suitable. None of them could carry a candle compared to Obama. And this is just absolutely false, and people are beginning to realize Obama is the most flawed president we've ever had, the weakest, most naive and childlike president we've ever had. And anybody in the Republican Party with conservative values could do a better job than Obama. So this idea of the secret knowledge is the theme of the book. Why is this theme so profound? Make contributions, please. I'm sorry, speak up, please.
I think Mammoth may be doing something that Dalton does in his play. It's making fun of the audience.
Well, expand upon that. Okay. Other contributions? I certainly agree that he is poking fun at him. I'm not sure that's the full reason why he adopted this theme.
But with his celebrity, it's, I think, powerful that he has made the realizations he has. He's written a book that probably be a bestseller. So I'm just looking at the potential influence from his book.
Okay.
And then zeroing in on a lot of the themes that many people, I think, really do understand the dismantling of culture, the American culture, and he's helping to bring that to light.
Okay. Rose?
Is he pointing out the limitation of buying into a secret knowledge? He's trying
yes.
to shatter that illusion?
I think so. I think the thing is that Marxism is like monarchy in that the monarch is the only one that can possibly lead the country. You have to have somebody in that lineage. So the right to be a monarch has to be passed on to a very select number of inbred people. And in Marxism, it's quickly the elitists. You know, the thing about, the reason why Europe is so prone to socialism is that socialism and Marxism is just feudalism in a new form. And the aristocracy, which was supposed to be overthrown with, in France, and other places, just reemerge as the aristocracy of the elite. And only they can do it. Only the master planners of the European market can do this. And only the inner cabal. And the notion of freedom is that we are capable of self-government. It's the same thing that I talk about with education. There's this illusion that only teachers can teach you. You have to go to a school, a government school, and be taught by government teachers how to approach life. You have to be indoctrinated. You have to be initiated. Well, in fact, what Plato says and what we've talked about before is Plato makes it clear that the teacher is a midwife and is helping you become a thinker that can produce thought babies. You can make the contact on your own. You don't need the teacher. You see, this has been one of the great conflicts of humanity throughout the ages. The Catholic Church itself, Jesus came and proclaimed that everything I have done, you can do an even greater thing. That doesn't sound like secret knowledge to me. It sounds like open knowledge.
And the church said, oh, no, no, we
exactly.
have to show you how
the
to do
the church turned that whole concept on its head, or ass, depending on your perspective, turned it on its head and said, as Rose just said, don't think for yourself. We'll do it for you. We'll tell you what to believe. All you need to do is believe it. And there are... It's incredible, but there are thousands of Christian ministers today, not Catholics, but Protestants, who every Sunday stand up in church and say, you don't need to understand this. This is beyond your comprehension. This is not something that you are privy to. We went to the seminary. We know about it. We have the inside scoop, but you don't. And don't you dare do it. This is why in England, the people that were responsible for printing the first Bibles, translating and printing the first Bibles, Wycliffe and others, Tyndale, were constantly being harassed by the law, and I think it was Tyndale that got burned at the stake for having the audacity to print a Bible that could be understood by the average person that didn't need the church to interpret it for them. And this is the secret knowledge concept. Don't think your way to God. You can't think your way to God. You have to rely on the church. Unless you go through the church, you're out of luck. Well, this was quite a struggle in the Catholic Church between Augustine and, I don't know, Anselm or somebody. the non-Augustine person, I think Anselm, wanted to basically teach all Christians meditation and how to make access to the soul. And Augustine would have none of it and lay down the law that this was the church hierarchy was the only way. Everybody else was a heretic. Well, that shut the door on true enlightenment for 1,500 years. And that I think, is why the secret knowledge. Yes?
I enjoyed reading Mammon's description of feminism, especially the part where he was talking about the criticism of the elite on Marilyn Monroe, and that she was just a hussy and blah, blah, blah. And he came out and said, look, Marilyn Monroe was a very good actress. She was a good comedian. She was successful. She had her flaws, granted. But the way the elite or the feminists just mocked her, probably out of jealousy. And that made me think today with Sarah Palin, with Michelle Bachmann. I mean, it's really, they would look at them. They are probably in a sense, they have gone beyond the goal of the feminists in their success, in their professionalism. Yet they still get mocked.
Sure.
Because they don't fit into that, whatever that inner sanctum is.
Right. And it's okay for liberals to promote Hillary or somebody else, but it's not okay for Republicans to do it because they... A Republican woman or a Republican black like Alan West is instantly labeled a traitor to the cause. All women must be feminists. All feminists are liberals, therefore all women must be liberals. And that's a complete assault on respect and individuality. So it's important to see these things and think them through and see how shallow these mockeries are.
I just have to, again, he was talking about the kids today who wear the wrinkled clothes and want to look more. And he said, you know, where are they getting those clothes from? You know, who's paying for them? They're
they're like expensive clothes, but they're trying to fit in.
Yeah.
And there's a joke always about all, say on Fox News, a lot of the commentators, the female, they're very attractive, you know, and somehow they've managed to be smart and attractive at the same time. And it's almost as though some of these feminists feel, unless if you, you know, have hairy armpits and over makeup or, you know, whatever, you don't fit the role, you don't fit the image.
Right. Good.
Kind of superficial, but I thought it was fun.
Yeah. Okay, yes.
When the joke said, I've always had with my, you know, I most of my attitudes are shaped of adults' toes, and they can't believe that I have five bypass opportunities to work in Boston or Philadelphia or Baltimore and come out to Ohio. They invariably ask, well, why would you want to go to Ohio? And I said, well, somebody has to do the missionary work, you know, and that would satisfy them, you know. But really, it's very hard for them to understand why I would even come out here, because of its conservative affiliation.
Right.
But, so I'm doing missionary work.
Yeah, I guess so. Now,
I married a porn star at Harvard.
So I have a comment about David Mamet, and that is sort of maybe flipping it a little on its from the other perspective is reading the article from the Village Voice and then starting to read the book. What occurred to me is like, okay, here this is very, you know, very famous, very much in the sort of New York elite circle, you know, people in New York with lots of power and influence.
Right.
And so what occurred to me is like, okay, you know, every time I think that, okay, surely people are going to see the hypocrisy of liberalism. And what happens is actually the opposite. So I'm just kind of waiting to see when and how he handles it when David Mamet is marginalized by liberals.
Yeah.
Well, he's just, you know, the guy's completely lost his mind, so we can ignore him. Clearly he's insane, so therefore, you know, we don't need to listen to him. He's no longer a reliable source of information because he's not spouting the dogma or the liberal doctrine, so boom, kick him to the curb, move on to the next one.
It will
curious if he'll take that sitting down or not.
Yeah, probably not. It will probably happen, but I think the answer to that lies in Bernie Goldberg, who was part of the mainstream media for a long, long time, and then came out with his books,
Bias
and whatnot, and blew the whistle, and the media immediately circled the wagons and ostracized him, and he has created a very successful career writing book after book, skewering the falsehoods and lies of the media. And of course, he's become a commentator on Fox News. So the whatever the attempt to ostracize Mamet is, will take the place, I'm sure it will, I think he's more than prepared for it. In the beginning of the first chapter or something, he talks about, he wrote a political play, and he describes some of the dialogue and whatnot. Well, I looked it up, I wasn't familiar with this, maybe some of you are, but the political play he's referring to, it was called November, because that's the month we elect presidents in, and it played on Broadway for a half a year in 2008, from January to July, which is a pretty good run on Broadway. And Nathan Lane played the character of the president. the government. It was up for election. And so this was after he outed himself in the Village Voice. And he still demonstrated the capacity to pack the theater and make his way. So I think his skills, I was thinking about this morning as I was showering, that he needed, being a Jew and being talented, he needed to be a liberal in order to be accepted as a writer, as a playwright, as a director. But he now has 40 years of track record behind him. So even though he's going to be ostracized to some degree, it's not entirely possible for everybody to ignore his credentials. And ultimately, the name of the game in Hollywood and on Broadway is to make money. And that trumps being a liberal or a conservative. So I think he will do all right. Yes.
I at first tried to get the book at the library.
Right.
Every library in Columbus has backups and holds on his book. And there's no way I was going to get it in time.
Well, that's a good sign, but it's also a sign that they grossly underordered the number of books they needed.
That's it.
And as Nancy will tell you, it's in libraries down here in Atlanta, conservative books don't even get ordered. Even though people come in and demand them, the people who order books for the library are so brainwashed by the left, they just figure that nobody will want to read them.
Well, maybe they were just educated in the Atlanta schools and, they passed that test. They actually can't read at all. So.
There's that distinct possibility. Okay, well, I'm interested in this book also, not just as the story of how a brilliant mind moves from liberal to conservative and thoroughly understands it and becomes an arch critic of the left. I'm interested in this book as a template for penetrating the illusions of any ideology and freeing ourselves from them. So I consider this a guidebook to shattering ideology. And of course, it could be the ideology of the right as well as the ideology of the left. The difference is that the left has created a religion, a theology out of other ideology. The right is, some people on the right are influenced by this, but they're also influenced by the values. They simply live the values of America, and that's the difference. So, Mamet has not exchanged one ideology for another. He has freed himself from the imprisonment of socialism. And I think that's very important, that this is a book of liberation. He has, which is the true meaning of liberal, by the way, somebody who is in favor of liberating the mind. The liberal arts are supposed to introduce to you the vast range of the mind, and instead, the liberal arts brainwash you. That's a complete distortion of the purpose of the liberal arts. But ideologies, theologies, and other mindsets all imprison the mind, not liberate them. And so we earn our freedom only by finding the higher truth within whatever system of thinking has been imposed upon us. And this is undoubtedly something that obviously all of you had some kind of religious background and you moved beyond it in order to embrace the ideas within the class that I teach. Not that I teach anything that's anti-religious or anti-theological, but it certainly is anti-theological, I take that back. But that you nonetheless, you jettison the shackles of narrow-minded thinking. So how have you experienced these bonds on thinking in your life, and how have you outgrown them and stopped letting yourself be controlled by ideology? Feel free to answer that question. Yes. Can you speak up a little bit, Betty?
When I was in college, I was in the Army Reserve, and it was anti all of my college friends who had been part of the protest movement. And, you know, it was hard to rationalize, it was hard for me to be among them and not think in terms of what they thought of.
Okay. Rose.
This was the Catholic Church. The first, I mean, obviously I grew up in the Catholic Church and was basically brainwashed, I guess.
Went to school.
Eight years of Catholic school, Mass. I went to Mass every day except Saturday. And the first disillusionment that I can remember is when they decided that it was okay now to eat meat on Friday.
Right.
I mean, I couldn't believe how they could just change something that was a mortal sin before. I think it was a mortal sin. And so that was the first crack. And from there, I started questioning, well, what else have they been telling me that was just for their convenience? And I think it begins with something like that, and then you have to have the courage to continue looking, continue examining, and, you know,
sure.
See what you find.
Okay, good. Other contributions here.
I can follow right by Rose. I know there was all connection rooms there. I mean, I had a lot more Catholic indoctrination than you ever did. But I think my turning point, I still remember when I went to the basic course for the first time, and at the end of the class, because I was anti-Bush and all that, and I said, how am I ever going to relate to these people? And then I started reading. And I started, I think, for the first time in my life, you know, really asking questions. And everything I was reading, it was like, oh my God, this makes so much sense. This is real. This is something that I'm not being told. This is something that I'm asking and I'm discovering. So it really was self-discovery, and it just continues and continues.
Good. For the record, that was probably after your first seminar rather than the basic course, because I...
Oh, maybe that was the first class. I just remember exactly.
I avoid, like the plague, talking about politics during the basic course.
Yeah, you know, I was living in Sunbury, so whenever that first meeting was, yeah.
Okay. Other contributions?
Jack Carl?
Yeah.
I was subjected through education. Well, it started when I was a youngster going to church and listening to professors, and I gradually developed it, you know, trying to live like Jesus, or that Christ was it was kind of a game that one played, and the whole object was that you couldn't become a Jesus, you couldn't become a Jesus or a Christ-like person. But, you know, it was like, it was called religious horseshoes. You pitch the horseshoes toward the pig, but you're blocked from ever scoring enough points to win the game. So this is how I developed the idea of Protestant ministers as supervising this game of celestial horseshoes where no one else won but them. And this took hold, I think, in grade school. And I was also then later subjected to the, you know, in my profession, the European socialism, particularly, you know, from the 30s on, maybe even a little bit earlier. So I was, it was a very difficult thing, and I still have trouble even using the word God because it was so violently eliminated from everything that I was read and thought. But it's been an interesting kind of experience just from the, you know, yeah, the two folks here that were very much involved in religion, and mine was just entirely different, but basically had somewhat the same effect, just by watching what the preachers, and nothing is, I haven't seen much except for one or two, you know, like a Burkhart or somebody like that. I haven't seen too many people really, who don't reflect that kind of attitude that they've got a special insight into something that they really don't understand or can't explain. So that gives a sense of ignorance there that I found a bit repulsive.
Sure. Good.
Yeah.
Other input.
Carl,
yes.
I was in New York in the mid to late 90s, and I was surrounded by liberal friends and really sort of lived the ideology, and I can't remember the name of the play or the individual that this group was trying to target, but I was walking past a theater, and there was a group that was yelling shame at, you know, this couple that was coming out of a limo going into the theater. And it was all about this person should be doing more to financially support research for AIDS. And I thought, you know, this isn't the way to go about that. So that was a big crack in, you know, in my understanding.
Good. So what is emerging here, I don't mean to shut anybody up, if you want to talk, jump right in. But what is emerging here seems to be a pattern of the events of life help conspire to break down the illusions, and then from that point on, you started thinking more carefully. That there's, we tend to get sucked into ideologies by a sloppy thinking. But as we learn to think more precisely and lucidly, we break this down. And this is a good process. It tends to be construed as painful by people who like to talk about pain and pleasure, but it's a healthy process of getting hold of your mind and exercising authority. Other input here. Yeah. Speak up a little bit.
I have enjoyed, and I'm trying hard, some of the comments about the Catholic Church. I can remember as a child being taught that only Catholics could get into trouble. And being so very conservative about this group's friends, it was Jewish and very, you know, close friends. Family. And asking that of the nuns in the CCD class, and then saying, of course, well, if they don't know any better, they would still have a chance. And, you know, as a young one sitting there saying out loud, that doesn't make sense when I'm 50, but then, you know, later on, of course, going back over at that.
Well, this is, I'm glad you brought this up, because this leads to something. I want to create in Walden Grove an atmosphere in which the student is encouraged to say out loud, that doesn't make sense. Now, hopefully, that situation would never come up, because the teacher wouldn't be off in la-la land. But if, whether it's the teacher or another student making some kind of asinine statement, students should have the sense of protection and comfort to be able to say, this doesn't make sense. And then the teacher or the other student should have the freedom to say, why not? Not just to accept it, but to say, why not? And give the person making the accusation a chance to explain why it doesn't make sense. And maybe it's just a question that they didn't understand it correctly, or maybe it's that they've been conditioned by a certain ideology or theology at home. But then, you see, that's what we're doing today. I'm tossing out ideas, you're responding to them. We are evaluating the responses in terms of, does this make sense or not? And it's not difficult to learn how to do. It's not difficult to learn to master. Excuse me. It's a question of, does it make sense? And if it doesn't make sense, you know, one of my fondest moments from when I was teaching Spanish was, there was a fellow that was in my class. He was also in my homeroom. And he was, he got a low B, B minus, C plus. He just sort of wandered back and forth between that. You may have heard part of this story before. And then he took the PSATs, preliminary SATs, and came back with a rating of 99th percentile. So I knew he was a fraud. I confronted him with this, and I said, it's only somebody who's really smart can get a 99th percentile rating on their PSATs. You're giving me this hokey show or performance that you are very deeply interested in Spanish, but you just can't do any better than you do. And I said, I'm blowing the whistle on you. You're just acting. You can do much better. And of course, from that point on, I don't think he ever got less than an A. But he readjusted his schedule in other classes so that they went back down to B minus C. Because he didn't want to work too hard. Still get what he wanted. But the point was, there was a time when I was about 2 months later in the class, I was lecturing about some aspect of Spanish grammar. And was just explaining this for the first time, and he sat in his chair and he said, Mr. Javixi, I don't think that's right. And he corrected me. And he was probably getting back for the confrontation, but he was right. He was absolutely right. I had slipped the gear and not conjugated something correctly or whatever, and he was able to edit my teaching. And I welcomed that. I thought that was the greatest moment of the year in my teaching, because I had taught a student successfully enough to be able to see my mistakes when I accidentally made them. Now, our educational system is not geared to encourage that. Walden Grove will encourage that kind of, you know, is this a line you're handing? That's kind of response. And it's not a question of doubt, it's more a question of incredulity. But this is beyond my belief structure, my capacity to understand. So it's very important to have that kind of freedom and integrity, intellectual integrity, to challenge the teacher if you're going to have any growth. Getting back to Mamet, or whatever his name is pronounced, the liberals make the government far more complex than conservatives, and by design, so that, of course, we have to turn to an elitist to run the country and to save ourselves from ourselves. Yet conservatives know that the key to governing well actually lies in the model of Calvin Coolidge, not Woodrow Wilson. And the history books have been written to promote Woodrow Wilson and debunk Calvin Coolidge. But it should be just the opposite way around. The Coolidge model is to govern with quiet efficiency. The Democrat model is to govern loudly and raucously, but without any concern for efficiency or fiscal responsibility. So, what is the real drama that motivated Mamet to make this radical change in his thinking? Anybody?
I'm not finished the book yet, Carl, but it seems to me he started to notice his own son and the friends of his son, and started noticing the younger generation developing the wrong way. He observed they didn't respect things they should respect.
Okay, I'm not looking for a specific event like that so much as a qualitative shift. Well, that's not to say that that's not a good observation, it is, but I'm looking more for a something, you know, what is that, what is the drama of this conversion represent in Mamet's life?
Well, he made some sort of connection with his soul.
Okay, Rose says he made a connection with his soul.
Which individualization.
Right. Well, I think it's a case that he always being creative and whatever, he always had a certain degree of responsiveness to his soul, or he wouldn't have been able to be creative. And as that filtered into his thinking, it began to have the quirksome effect that he began questioning values that he hadn't thought about. And that's the drama is the soul takes over and rescues him from his self-created pit of ignorance.
Carl?
Yes.
I'm interested in the role of this space. And all of that just popped into my mind. Surely they were thinking through this whole process of guiding. And I'm sure it was just the idea that it was there, this propensity to think this through and to develop this data, like you said.
Sure.
Really moving this conservative, even though he identified.
The life of a spook in a situation like that is one of enormous frustration. And I'm letting some spooks here of my own answer this question. But it's one of enormous frustration, as is the case for spooks in general. Frustration is their middle name, because they try to get an idea through your thick skull and you twist it and turn it, and it comes out completely different. Until you learn to pay attention to them and actually create a clear channel for communication, and you ask them for help, and even then, their help may be somewhat colored and distorted by your prejudices. But This whole whole thing is a question of focus. When a mind like Mamet's is focused in certain liberal assumptions and there's no reason to question them, nothing gets through that contradicts it. And so only a relatively advanced person would wake up in the middle of the night and say, oh my God, I've been living a lie. But it has been known to happen. In his case, it had to happen a little bit more by inference, and that is, he gradually began to see the writing on the wall that liberalism was not the answer. So it was a slow process. The major factor was he met this rabbi in Hollywood who was conservative. And introduced him to conservative thinking, and then he did the rest on his own. So instead of, the soul had to work through this other person. Now, the one thing that keeps spooks from being too frustrated is they know, in most cases, that there's going to be an awakening at a certain age. And they just humor them until there's a, till they grow up enough to wake up. Does that answer your question?
It does. For me, you talked about it being so well known. I like to talk about that. It's just something that has to be done.
I'm having a hard time hearing you now.
I said, I was thinking also, and Bob mentioned about the backlash from the he made the comment about his, all he had achieved. So he's too well known to be ignored, and I rather like that. So it would be interesting to observe. And in fact, maybe it needed to happen that way for him to truly, make the contribution.
Sure.
That we can now make, so.
Right. And the other aspect of it is if the left pushes him too much and says, you've changed, you've become irrelevant, we're going to ignore you, he has the perfect platform to lash back at him and say, oh, by the way, everything I did before I was 55, pure bunk. And anybody who accepts it and thinks that was my true voice, you're really stupid. See, so it's a trap. If they protest too loud, he's got them by the short hairs. And so he's in a good position if he's, and I think he's clever enough to recognize that. Okay, that's enough today for, yes.
When was the book first published? When did it come out? I know it's 2011.
Well, about a month or two ago. It came out, I was first aware of it just after I announced Walden Ultra, which is why it wasn't included in the first announcement. It came out probably in June.
Actually, Rush had an interview with him on the radio, which is where I heard about him.
And we decided to immediately get the book and start reading it.
It just sounded so good, so incredible.
Let me add this. For those of you who have liberal friends who refuse to follow the footsteps of Mamet on their own, this would be a good book to challenge them to read. Well, maybe not challenge them. Gently suggest they read it, and if they refuse to say, well, I thought you were a bold adventurer, and it turns out you're a mental coward, or words to that effect. But to challenge them to read this book and expose their ideas to the same ideas that Mamet exposed his ideas to. So...
I've got someone in mind. I could
I'm sure all of us have more than one that we can think of. Okay, end of that period. Now we go into our session of presentation. Now, this may seem like a silly exercise to some of you, but in fact, over the years, many of you have progressed quite nicely in your presentation skills. And this is an integral part of the Walden Grove experience, is to make people comfortable with speaking in front of a group, whether small group or large group, and acting and reciting and presenting things. So this is not a question of speaking ad lib. We've got text to read, but I want you to read the assigned passage and project it and put your all your skills of self-expression to work here to convey effectively the ideas to the rest of the group. So those of you who I've had to say speak up, make sure you're positioned right in front of your microphone. We're going to start with, we're working with the Fabled Gate. We're going to start with the poem about Midas, and we will read one stanza apiece, and then we'll, if there are any stanzas left over after we go through everybody, we'll start the sequence again. So the sequence is Mary reads stanza 1, Mimi reads stanza 2, Nancy reads stanza 3, Rose reads stanza 4, Bill 5, Donna 6, Judy 7, Dorothy 8, yes.
The dog ate my homework.
The dog ate your homework.
I have to eat my coffee at the table. I didn't realize it was the same thing.
Okay, well, you're still in sixth spot unless you don't get back in time.
Hey, Carl.
Yes.
I had ordered the Fabled Gate, and it hasn't come yet.
It hasn't? Oh, my.
It should.
Wow. That's going
to
be...
Let me go out and check the mail to see if it came today.
All right, why don't you check, and because you're numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Betty is 9, Ann Harper is 10, Louise 11. Have I left anybody out?
I cannot find mine. I'm looking for it now. Sorry.
Wow.
Well, I'm not sure I have it. I have things in different places.
All right. Go look.
What are we reading for?
I am. I'm looking at
it. Okay. That's fine.
Carl, tell me what number I am. I have to go
now. All right. Mary is 1. Mimi 2, Nancy 3, Rose 4, Bill 5, Donna 6, Judy 7, Dorothy 8, Betty 9, Ann 10, and Louise 11.
Carl, mine has not come. This is Dorothy.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe I can double up on Wednesday.
All right. I'm sorry. I thought we were getting that to you in plenty of time, but... all I can say is it's in the mail.
Well, which one did you say we're reading?
We're starting with Midas on page 32.
Okay.
And so let's give people another minute or so to return from their hunting for the copy. Donnie, you found it?
Yep.
Good.
Hi.
Yes?
Hi.
Good.
This is Judy.
All right. Ann, did you have something?
Well, I'm not sure how much we're supposed to read, just like the paragraph.
One stanza. One stanza each. That's 4 full lines. Or,
yeah.
You know, when you get to...
What's a stanza? Just where those spaces are?
Yeah. When you come to a space, you're done. Right. Now, since Dorothy doesn't have the Fabled Gate, if you don't get it by tomorrow, let me know and I'll email you what we'll do on Wednesday.
Okay.
So you have it. It probably went out last week sometime. Anyway, so once again, the order, this time I'm going to change the order slightly because Dorothy drops out. Well, I'll tell you what, today I'll read Dorothy's part. Dorothy, you'll never sound so good. Sorry. So that we can keep the order. So the order is Mary, Mimi, Nancy, Rose, Bill, Donna, Judy, Dorothy, Betty, and Anne and Louise. So Mary, whenever you're ready.
Is it Selenus or Silenus?
Well, I would say it's Selenus, teacher of the God of Wine.
All right. Selenus, teacher of the God of Wine, consumed too much the nectars of the vine, wandered off, lost his way one day, too soon worried of his virtue.
The old man found a net of proper straw, was taken to the king to judge by law. Selenus told him the king quite well, exclaimed, "You fool, you thought you were in power."
Nancy? Oh, Nancy. I see you there. I don't hear you. Maybe Nancy can't be heard. Well, all right, I'll substitute for her until we hear from Nancy. Midas embraced his friend and bade the court extend them common courtesies. In short, for 10 whole days, they drank each other's health. For 10 whole nights, they drank each other's wealth.
Then Midas sent for Bacchus, god of wine, to join Silenus at his court and dine. Wise Bacchus, reunited with his friend, begged Midas' name a gift a god could send.
Being king, there is a little that I crave, where I am a master while others play the slave. But there's one town I should like to hold, to turn whatever I might touch to gold.
It's done, said Bacchus as he drank and ate, but not a favor worthy of your state. Midas moved as if to hug the god, but Bacchus deftly stayed him with a nod.
With glee, the king plucked from the tree a twig. It turned to gold. And Midas danced the jig. He touched a stone, he walked across the world. Everything he touched, he turned to gold.
Returning home, he sought a loaf of bread. But as he bit, his brow filled up with dread. Once touched by him, the loaf to gold was turned. He tried some mead, then really got concerned.
Set off at once, his chore to trace the living stream to its first shore. Once there, he plunged his head and body, and the sands turned gold for the cleansing of his sin. To celebrate this rest from himself, the king gave up his crown as well as wealth. He lived a humble life and worshipped Pan, and learned to find the majesty in man.
Good. How about that? 11 stanzas, just the right number for everybody to read. Now, I'm not sure that all the subsequent ones we do here will be exactly 11 stanzas. So if we fall short, we'll pick up the one after that. If we go long, we'll go back to the beginning and Mary does the 12th and so on. So the next one in order is Phaeton. This is the myth of Apollo and Phoebus. Apollo, the sun god, also known as Phoebus, who drives the chariot of the sun across the sky each day. Phaeton is the sun, and like every sun, he wants to show that he can outdo his old man. And so this is the story of his adventures. Mary, begin again. Right.
Tis by his mates as fallen from above. Young Young Phaeton aches for great Apollo's love to prove he sprung from the Apollonian line, a sturdy branch of Phoebus's strong vine.
Confronting his mother, mild flaming, a nymph as fair as any fairy. He asks to know if whispers bear the truth. Am I Apollo's son, his own forsooth?
A ray of sunshine dances on her lips as Clymene recollects the many trips Apollo made to sleep with her at night to give her Phaeton for her own delight.
Great Phoebus is your sire, my son, but why ask me? Ask him. His temple lies nearby. Let him inspect the product of our joys and ask him to endower you with his toys.
These were her words, and the son was gone, found for his father called him. Yet I upon it, but I can see
a man of fall. Constructed all in light, Phaeton scarce could look, it was so bright, the symbols of the moon and earth and sky, etched in its brilliance, blinding to the eye.
Across the ceiling arched the zodiac, each sign alive and moving on its track. The ram looked down and saw the lad draw nigh. What brings you to the palace of the sky?
Phaeton blushed. The hall blushed in reply, then rattled greatly, ending with a sigh. Apollo appears as from oblivion. What brings you hither, Phaeton, my son? Shook his sunlit head. The gift you ask for fills me with great dread. Not even Jupiter or Mars has ever sought to drive my chariot, O fatal thought.
I must, said Phaeton. You can't, cried Phoebus. Release me from my oath. I find it grievous. To drive my car requires the utmost skill. The odds you would survive fall short of nil.
Volume, my son.
so his sire surrendered to his son and his desire. Just then, the god of time proclaimed the dawn. The new day's come, O Lord, you must be gone.
An ostler brings the chariot to the hall, harnessed to a team of five, of six fire breathers all, expecting Phoebus to assume his place, embarking on his daily chore with grace.
The chariot is a wonder to behold, a gift from Vulcan, hammered out of gold, encrusted all with diamonds and jewels, as would befit the god who daylight rules.
Extremes. Within the middle zone, the route to take by my old tracks is shown. Be wary of the dangers you will find. Stay focused in your duty to mankind.
He answered from the fiery crown, which warms earth as the carriage makes its round. The great doors open, let me in. The horses below it rough catch the prevailing wind.
Caught by surprise, Phaeton lets slip the reins. He recovers, but the message still remains. The horses, sensing a lighter grip and skill, veer off the track to test the driver's will.
The initial climb into the sky is steep, jolting Phaeton from his dreamlike sleep. Too late, he understands Apollo's love, lamenting his desire to drive above.
Charge his speed to take the chance to wander from the path in front of his hands. Without Apollo's path to show the way, and Fate quickly guides the team through it.
The unrestricted team rocks wild and free, now soaring high, now sweeping low with glee. Fate's crown of sun bobs up and down, first charring stars, then scorching castors round.
Confused, Phaeton tries to set things right. He seeks his bearings to stabilize the flight. Doomed youth, toward Scorpio's claws he streaks, who bats him like a ball to Asian peaks.
All chaos follows in the chariot's wake. As Phaeton swoops, fertile valleys bake. Mountain snows melt to flood the lands below. Great cities burn, the winds forget to blow.
Of Apollo weep and mourn, their tears and song of silver verse, earth's reborn. 'Tis noble to aspire to godly heights, but folly to indulge in naive heights.
Good. I think everybody did fine, especially since you didn't have a chance to rehearse this. You're putting good inflection and in many cases emotion into this, which enhances the meaning, and I think that's good. I think that's it for today. We will resume on Wednesday This gives you a breather, gives me a breather, and gives you a chance to read some more and be ready with the assignments for Wednesday. Any comments or questions before we...
Yes, what's the assignment for Wednesday?
The assignment, oh, that's right. You were disconnected during that period of time when I talked about that. You're reading Daffodil, the story Daffodil by Kenneth Morris in Sophie 24.
Page 104.
It starts on page 104. And you're reading more of The Ethics of Aristotle and The Secret Knowledge of David Mamet. And that's the entirety of your homework. Yes.
When I pull up Aristotle, I get like 8 books. Are we to read them all?
No, just Ethics.
Yeah.
There's 10 chapters in Ethics, but there should be, if you put in Aristotle Ethics, you should get only the translations of his Ethica Nicomachea.
Well,
yeah.
I just left my Sophie 23
Now I think that's Judy putting her phone down somewhere. You said something about Sophie 23. We don't have an assignment in Sophie 23 until August.
Well, she'd like to order one.
You want to order a Sophie
23? Yeah. I left mine at the doctor's office.
Okay. Well, I'm sure people are reading it and enjoying it. All right. So we'll send you a copy of Sophie 23, and hopefully you'll get it faster than Dorothy is getting her copy of Sophie, or the Babel Gate. Good. Anybody else need something sent to them?
Yeah, Carl, I was just going to ask about the musical selections. Will you have files attached to, like, something that you have the files on? I don't know what it was. The music just over the date of times, and I got very little of that. So I would like to listen to them if you're...
I'll see if I can attach a file. I don't know. Sometimes tunes are a little bit difficult and dicey to send, but I'll try to send it to you.
Well, if you cannot, I'll look them up. That's all.
Yeah. Anybody else? Anything else? Well, we will see you Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. And we'll have another good day. So thank you and enjoy the night.
Thank you.